Ringtone Club, episode 18. We are recording on the 17th of February, 2019, for release on the 19th of February, 2019. This is your fortnightly look at manga. We will focus on joint discussion. My name is Elliot Page. Fresh from an excruciatingly boring but very useful training course in the nation's capital, which I have come to loathe, frankly. But I'm joined by my intrepid co-host from the north, Mr. Andy Hanley. How are you feeling, Andy?
I currently feel like I've kind of become the star of a chapter of Cells at Work, but apart from that, you know, pretty good. I think this is the chapter where they show what happens to your body if you get, like, two illnesses at the same time. And the answer is, like, it's really gross and it involves lots of mucus. So, fun times.
Yeah, if we were to zoom in on your body, there'd be a hella gross stuff happening if that manga has prepared me at all for it.
Sadly, little use for cute platelets, so I feel like I have all the wrong diseases.
Man, that's just, poor platelets. They try their best. Oh, dear. So, yep, thank you very much for listening. Just as a quick note, we have a Patreon, if you so fancy, if you would like more manga goodness in your veins. On that note, we have our shout out section. You too can get shouted out on the podcast for on our higher tier for the backers. Our current only and returning shout out champion is Mr. Rob Jessup. Thank you very much, Rob. Much appreciated. We also, for those of you who are on the Patreon, get to vote for what our bonus episode is going to be, where you get to vote, we then have to read it and talk about it. And our bonus episode for February is, I'm not going to drum roll because I don't have any services apart from the desk this microphone is on, so just insert it yourself. Our next bonus episode is Dr. Stone, the first volume of the Shonen Jump post-apocalypse alchemy/basic physics series. So we'll be talking about that, and thankfully we both on the Shonen Jump app, so you can read it completely free. I don't know about you, Andy, but I have previously dipped into Dr. Stone, and I already have strong opinions on it, so I'm looking forward to sort of getting down dirty on that with you.
Yeah, I've not actually checked any of it out myself, but it's certainly one of those names that keeps kind of popping up in my Twitter feed with people saying various things about it. Like, I've seen quite a wide gamut of opinions, so I'm looking forward to forming some of my own.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm not trying to cannibalize podcast material, but my opinion of it before I actually sat down and read it, you know, when it was just like, oh, what's this? Ooh. Changed very rapidly when I started reading it, and it's like, oh man, this is okay. I'm having lots of thoughts here, so we'll see how that comes out in the episode. But if you want to listen to that bonus episode, I'm afraid you'll need to join up to the Patreon, but it's from $1 a month, so up to you. So moving on to our first main part of this episode is Returning Champions, where we talk about shows we've talked about before on this podcast, just as a little check-in, you know, just a little peek around the curtain. So first and foremost, I think it's one we can both jump in on, Andy, is The Promised Neverland, which we are both keeping up on via the Shonen Jump app when I remember which chapter I got to and don't have to reread half of it all over again because my memory is bad. Promised Neverland. I think, Andy, all I can really say at this point is, oh boy.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the exciting thing is kind of, and I'm almost hoping this isn't just kind of like a false sort of dawn, but it feels like we can kind of see like the actual end game for the series in sight now. It feels like it's kind of set up like here's the final kind of, you know, things that need to be done, and you know, the latest chapter that we both read, I assume, has kind of set up the prospect that there are kind of two ways of looking at the whole situation. Which is one of those things. It kind of caught me unawares, and then I kind of chastised myself. I've been like, well, of course, this is how this whole debate was going to go, because, like, given the characters involved, this all makes complete logical sense. But yeah, like we can kind of see where the lines are being drawn. There are some very interesting things around certain characters that are both sort of clarified and then just thrown back up in the air again, like in basically the same chapter or two. So yeah, there's still a lot to get your teeth into, and the series continues to be the master of the cliffhanger, kind of week by week, of just like dropping a bombshell and then just stepping away and leaving you to mull over it until the next chapter lands.
Yeah, as I say, have I said in the previous podcast, my forgetfulness has come in really handy because I end up forgetting about the series for weeks on end and then remembering about it, fiending for it, getting to read it through the app, and then going, oh man, I'm caught up. Oh, thank goodness my memory is terrible. So I didn't have to spend 3 weeks fiending constantly for this, which is one of the benefits of the whole, like, you know, same day release thing that we've now got going on. But yeah, as you say, like, I feel like, I mean, the authors have said in previous discussions that we are gearing up towards an ending now, and it certainly feels like we now have as many cards as I can see on the table, certain things clarified, some of which not to my full taste, but I'm certainly appreciative of how it's worked out. And there's now a very clear conflict which exists in the core of the series beyond the existing one of, oh no, we're going to get eaten. And it's really fascinating to see. And also just there's going to be some stuff going down, which sounds really vague of me, and it is, but it is a case of like, man, I can't wait to see how this plays out. And I really don't know what the heck's going to happen here. Like, I have some ideas, but man, I want to see what the hell happens now. And yeah, as usual, it's really good fun, really fascinating. The most recent sort of revelation is to the state of the world and the, like, antagonists is definitely a head scratcher. So looking forward to seeing how this all resolves. So yeah, Promised Neverland, still good. I haven't watched the anime. I've been quietly prodding friends who, like, mutual friends who do watch the anime to read the manga. So I've become that guy, as it turns out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I certainly know of at least one person who kind of started reading the manga, then said, ah, you know what, the anime is coming along, I'm gonna watch that and see how that goes. And then they have got a few episodes into the anime and just said, I can't wait anymore. I need to jump back to the manga now because I can't do this waiting to find out what happens next thing when I know there is so much of the story still to run. So it's certainly doing its job of pushing people towards the source material.
Yeah, I feel like it's three My Hero Academias on the, oh snap, I just need to read the manga now, don't I, scale, where, yeah, like, My Hero Academia had that effect on me, but I resisted, and then I went, oh, sod it, let's just, like, binge, and I did. That's another series I need to catch up on. Man, that series is in a bit of a weirder territory at the moment. We'll see where it goes, but anyway, I want you to catch up on that at some point. Have you caught up on My Hero Academia, Andy?
No, I kind of switched to just watching the anime at some point. But yeah, I've very much had the similar thing of, like, especially with the Shonen Jump app as it is now, of just kind of switching back and going back to the manga again so that I can be proper up to date, as it were.
Yeah, fair. Okay, so talking about other series we've talked about previously, Kaguya-sama, Love is War. I don't know about you, Andy, but I buckled and have bought volumes 2 and 3 of it. I've only read volume 2 so far. Have you been keeping up on this? I know we talked about it last time.
Yeah, I've not read any more of the manga. I am still keeping up with the anime, which I feel like I'm enjoying more and more by the week. The anime has now introduced the fourth student council member.
Oh, I haven't seen him yet. Damn.
Yeah, the poor guy. As you can imagine, he has kind of a rough time. So yeah, it's the anime continues to be fantastic. Like, it is my kind of laugh out loud show of the season. It just seems to get funnier and funnier and kind of more on the nose and kind of lands its jokes better every single week. So yeah, I think I may well dip into the manga. Whether I wait till the anime is finished or whether I just kind of buckle and do it before that, I don't know. But yeah, I'm definitely enjoying the viewing experience, if nothing else.
Fair dues. Yeah, I'm keeping on the manga. I read volume 2. Chika Fujiwara continues to be possibly the best and worst character in existence.
an agent at the same time.
Yeah, just an agent of pure chaos. And she turns up in a Deerstalker hat at some point, and she apologizes for having to go take time to pick it up. And it's like, oh yeah, there's a load of different bits in the volume 2 that are just kind of, it's wild because, you know, we already know the premise, we know the boundaries of what is going to happen. The pair of them are going to be idiots and try and get each other to confess, but it just spirals out constantly. It's real wild. I feel like it's made this setting its own in a really smart way. Like, it now has so much material to play with and how it's willing to use that sort of idea. There was a section, the most recent chapter at the end of volume 2 was about a French exchange trip they had to organize.
Yes, okay.
Which got real wild at the end. I'm like, whoa, this is oof. Like, but also at the same time, it does really well at the whole, like, ships passing in the night thing between Miyuki and Kaguya, where goddamn, those two are going to crash right into each other at some point, but not yet, as it turns out. Also, I thought I'd cut you out. But yeah, it's a good fun read. I'm really enjoying it. I keep meaning to watch the anime, but blah, blah, time, etc. And finally, the Elliot Page light novel corner. I also continued reading My Life as a Villainess, All Roots Lead to Doom, Volume 2, via the J Novel Club app, which thankfully does save where you have gotten to in settings, so you can actually pick it up again. And yeah, it's Volume 2 of that series, which sounds very flippant and offhandish, but it works well. It has the main character, Katarina, the aforementioned villainess slash moron, going to school where the Otome game that she remembers from her previous life happens, and she manages to survive her first year there, kind of. Well, she does. She survives, but things go stupid and wrong. The one problem I'll say is that because basically the main character has an entire orbiting cast of characters, is that it makes quite a few scenes a bit heavy or overstay their welcome when it's like, okay, thing happens, reaction from suitor 1, reaction from suitor 2, reaction from suitor 3, on throughout the entire cast. And so basically a few pages later, you're like, oh Christ, Jesus. It's like old JRPG syndrome where every last mofo who's present has to say something. And I think it's taking care of that slightly because Volume 3 has just started and it's thinning out the cast a little in terms of who's present when. So it's not just like, okay, everyone's here again and everyone's here again and everyone's here again. So I'm glad it's getting rid of that because, man alive, it was starting to get real tiresome by the end of this second volume. But yeah, it continues to be charming in the like guileless, amusing way that I do enjoy of like, because the main character is such a like a guileless, earnest, innocent dimwit, everyone else is just won over by her, and it still continues to work on that front, which is nice. It's nice to have a character isn't just like, you know, he like not even aware they have a harem sort of thing. It's not like most harem comedies where they go, oh no, Doshio, I have the harems, you know, sort of garbage.
Yeah, does it keep up kind of the same cadence as the first volume of kind of having like the main character's point of view and then switching to an alternate point of view, or was that just kind of a vehicle for the story in the first volume?
It does still have that. It does still have that less often, and when it does crop up, it's slightly longer. It is interesting in some instances because it shows much more interesting sort of sets of characters studies where they couldn't really do that character discussion with Katarina there, but or what in, you know, in actual conversation, because it'd be really ham-fisted as exposition. At the same time, it does get tiring. It's still there less often, but still there. Thankfully, it's not repeating every single time, which is nice. There's a side story at the end with the main like prince character, which is just kind of like, yeah, I get it. Yep, I get it. Yep. So, but yeah, I feel like the series is definitely getting more confident, though. From reading the author's note, this second volume was written in 2 months after the first one. So holy cow. They got a move on. Clearly, they knew they were onto something and was like, quick, must capitalize before everyone gets bored. But yeah, volume 3 is now going up on J-Level Club. I still have my subscription, so I'll just read that when I get a chance. Sure. So, but yeah, I'm enjoying it. It's very, compared to a lot of light novels, which I kind of am leery of because they go somewhat deaf or leery or tone, you know, just gross. This is nice to have as a like, oh, this is quite pleasant. Like, the main character is winning out through friendship. So sometimes that's all you really want is a friendship story. Oh dear. But yeah, it's still good fun. It's worth a read if you fancy it. Oh dear. So yeah, moving on. We have our manga picks for this week, this fortnight even. So if you don't mind, Andy, I'll go first with my
one. Yes, yeah, I think that's probably a good order to do things.
Yes, so I picked Crocodile Baron Volume 1, as mentioned previously, because I bought it twice in different digital storefronts and got annoyed with myself. So I thought, well, I've got to read this at some point and not just have it moulder in two different digital lockers. But Crocodile Baron is a 3-volume series. 2 volumes are out so far in English. It's complete in Japanese at 3 volumes. It's published by Kodansha here, and the author is Takiya Okada. And the name is pretty much on the nose. You have a crocodile. I forget his name, but it's very fancy. Very, very fancy.
Alfardo J. Donson.
Donson, that's it, yes. Mostly called Sensei by his idiot fuckhead rabbit friend who I hate but is still a useful character. Mr. Rabbit Boy or whatever. That fucking... He's got good taste in t-shirts though, which is very important for manga. I love a good non sequitur t-shirt in anime or manga. I mean, hell, look at Sorimachi. So anyway, it's a really weird series. It's basically a gourmet slash cooking manga. Like, it's a food manga because the Baron is like a quiet sort of like affected top hat wearing cane using crocodile who's quite posh and is like a man of letters, I suppose would be the way of putting it, if that phrase works. Like, you hear about this in like Victorian Edwardian times when it's like, oh, this was a person of letters because they were kind of a pseudo philosopher, discussion dandy, well-off man about town who like had the social status to not get their hands dirty and so could just be part of the discourse of the time. And so he has this modest little house and he writes for a living, and he basically meets up with his little rabbit friend, Bunny Boy or whatever, who is a little prick, immature little twit, and or other characters, and he just kind of like goes on little culinary journeys, either by accident or intent. And it kind of goes from there, where he like has the little whole food manga revelation metaphor thing, like where he talks about the udon as if it was the bullet train, which was pretty funny, and has memories back to his past, his wild beginnings in Africa on the Nile, which is a really weird running joke that I still quite found really funny, if a bit spooky after the first time. And it's bizarre because the world it's set in there's no people or humans. You have humanoid characteristic animals, but they still look like perfect animals. Like, Donson like walks on two legs, the rabbit walks on two legs, they still have all their features. Like, if anything, Donson is kind of spooky because he's like a picture perfect, like photographically drawn crocodile, and it looks awesome, but it's kind of weird where it's like the author is clearly working really hard to give him like expressions rather than just, hi, I'm a crocodile, I'm gonna eat you. And so basically it's a case where it's this mismatched thing of rabbit wants to go eat stuff, like crocodile goes with him, they meet an armadillo who is like a neat basically and a weird little weaselly prick, and it kind of goes from there in this weird little fancy world where like you have both wild animals and clearly there are like living breathing cows who are like sentient, but then they also eat beef, so there's that weird bit. And it's kind of, you don't want to think about it too hard. That's what I'm doing. I'm thinking too hard about it. But yeah, it's this kind of bizarrely charming, well-drawn work about this crocodile having little weird gourmet adventures with his idiot rabbit friend, and like discovering the nature of food and himself and kind of coming to regret his wild beginnings and his like weaknesses, he would think. So yeah, it's really bizarre. It's real wild. It's real wild in just how strange and structured it is. And the one thing I will say, the one thing I'll definitely like mark down is that the speech in it, the actual writing is really weird at times. Like, often it felt like the characters are talking past each other and not actually engaging in a conversation. Like, more than once, I'm like, what is going on with this conversation? Like, they're not actually really talking to each other or really engaging. And especially the rabbit, because I didn't like him anyway, because he's a prick. He has his use, but it's just like, how are they talking to each other? Where is this going? And it feels very disjointed in that regard. But I did enjoy it, even if it made me scratch my head like a madden. Given that it's only 3 volumes, I'll probably pick up the remaining 2 because it's like weird enough that I found it interesting and I'm kind of curious to see what the hell else it does in its really strange little world. But yeah, Andy, what did you think about me inflicting this upon you?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like out of everything that I've kind of read for this podcast, like, this feels like the weirdest thing that I've read thus far. I mean, I literally...
Hey, wait, we're comparing this to the Voynich Hotel, Andy, bear in mind.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like even that, even that has a sort of grounding that gives you kind of a ground floor for its weirdness. You kind of, it sets up right from the get-go, like, hey, look, this is what you're in for here. And like, maybe it was just kind of like pre-knowledge from you know, seeing other people talking about it. Like, I knew what I was getting into with that. I'm not sure exactly what my expectation of Crocodile Baron was, but there was definitely a point in my notes where I've just written in all caps, things get weird. And
yeah.
Like, that's kind of like the sort of the cadence of the entire, of almost every element of the series. I mean, it's like kind of the our beloved rabbit boy, who kind of starts out like he's just going to be your kind of like cheerful, upbeat, slightly stupid kind of, you know, sidekick character that kind of, you know, drags our Crocodile Baron into, you know, whatever culinary kind of thing that he's going to get into. But then there are just these weird moments where just like Rabbit Boy just starts like spewing hatred at people, and just like not just being a bit of a jerk, but like kind of being like a really aggressively terrible person. And yeah, then suddenly kind of just like snaps back to being just like happy, fun time rabbit friend. And it's just like there's these weird kind of tonal shifts that the other characters sort of have as well. I mean, I guess like it's far more kind of on the nose in terms of like Alfonso J. Donson's kind of thing, where he just suddenly just goes wild quite literally and just starts like eating everybody's roast beef, which again, like, is another good sort of like analog for the series as a whole. It just has these moments that are really funny, but there's always just something that feels really kind of unsettling and just off about it. Like, it always feels like it's teetering on the precipice of just turning into something absolutely horrific. Like, if, like, even the artwork of like the rabbit character, like he sits in an uncanny valley in just this weird place where it's like, okay, he's a kind of, you know, an anthropomorphized sort of like rabbit human thing. He's just rabbit enough to be a rabbit, but he's also just human enough to be like eerily human. And that was kind of like the thing that sat with me throughout this entire volume. I always like, no matter whether I was kind of laughing at a joke or kind of like amused by a weird bullet train metaphor or whatever, there's always just this weird unsettling undercurrent that I think kind of a combination of the artwork and the story beats and, like you say, sometimes the characters talking past one another, that just made it feel a bit like a sort of weird fever dream that was about to turn into like a bad trip at any given moment.
Yeah, that's especially about the rabbit boy. I definitely agree, where at times it felt like he was about to dip into just full-on weird pseudo-racism. I mean, he kind of does anyway.
Yeah, he kind of does. He sort of goes white supremacist at times. It's like, oh, this is not good.
But yeah, but at the same time, the boundaries aren't really established, so it's really strange. And like, he always catches himself and goes, oh, I'm very sorry. It's like, I think it kind of comes across that he is like the little kid who is trying so, so hard to impress someone he likes that he just manages to slather himself in garbage constantly. Like you see that like with kids and just people in general are like, oh, I must impress this person. Whoops, I just offended everyone. But yeah, that is more scary to me than Alfonso getting a bit, you know, sort of feeling the call of the wild. I mean, other sort of weird like humanisms is like one of the chapters you get introduced to this like shithead armadillo, and then you meet his mum at the end and she's got lipstick on and it's really bizarre because there's no lips on that thing.
Yeah.
And they go to weird animal Osaka with like shithead cats, and it's just Osaka. It looks like Osaka, yes, except with animals. It's so weird.
It really is. But yeah, I mean, I think that was kind of the thing that was probably the biggest negative of the volume for me, was just like, although ostensibly, like you say, it is just kind of a weird sort of food / gourmet manga, it felt like it was trying to do several things and was kind of very much a jack of all trades, master of none at them, because you've got that whole kind of food angle to it. There's also kind of a clear sort of like wildlife facts angle to it, like, you know, with, again, the armadillo is a good example of that, where it just throws in a few facts like, well, you've been thrown out by your mum because this is what armadillos do. They get, like, dropped off of a hill twice because then they'll learn to curl up into a ball and stuff like that. And then you've got this sort of weird, sort of more kind of thoughtful piece on kind of human nature and behavior and kind of, you know, what separates us from animals, etc., etc. And it kind of like every chapter sort of dips into all of those things, but never quite like submerses itself in them enough to say like, oh, okay, you know, here's what you're getting at in this particular chapter. It's this weird sort of, you know, potpourri of these different elements, but you never quite get enough of any one of them to be like, oh yeah, I enjoyed that angle of it. So it was kind of that was perhaps just another part of the weirdness for me. Like, I could never quite latch on to any one thing it was doing and say, oh yeah, I liked that part of it.
Yeah, like, as you say, there's as part of that, there's no like principal angle that it then spins off of, because it just starts in all these different manners and I was worried by the second chapter it was going to do the whole like crocodile goes wild every chapter, and I was like, oh, please don't make this that redundant. But it just kind of goes all over the shop. But it's like weird family discussions. There's some hyenas and all this stuff, and there's a nice little extra chapter at the end which is quite nice and heartfelt in a weird way. But and you know, it's all really well drawn as well. Like, it's kind of, that's one of the things that's kind of wild about it, is like, I feel like the author like picked their line and sticks to it. Like, I would not have the patience to draw in the like little square like black scales on Alfonso's like chest. Like, I would get real fed up of that real fast. But they stuck to their guns and they continue drawing that crocodile looking scarily lifelike, although on two legs. So what? But yeah, it's a really good bit actually, where he's quite looking forward to having a cup of tea in this cafe, and he starts wagging his tail, and he's like, "What? What is he, a cat?" It's, as you say, it's a real strange one. I'm glad I read it, but at the same time, as I say, I'm probably going to pick it up at least volume two to see what the hell they're going to do next. Because if nothing else, it's made me very curious. Because what the hell?
yeah. I mean, it was the weird thing about it. Like, although, you know, I'm not kind of leaping off my seat to kind of tell people, oh, go read it now, it's amazing. Like, it did compel me to kind of read it all in one hit from beginning to end. Like, I did find it weirdly unputdownable. I'm like, what is this? Like, every chapter I was kind of expecting some kind of grandiose penny to drop. I'm like, no, this is what we're really doing here. We're building to this specific thing. And it's like, no, you're not actually, are you? But like, I need to see what happens next. I need to see what this weird, like, Jacob Rees-Mogg crocodile is gonna do next.
Oh no, you ruined it for me.
You see, that also didn't help. Like, I made that kind of analogy early on as like, is this just like the Jacob Rees-Mogg of crocodiles? Because if so, I don't like him already.
Oh, god damn it, Andy. God. Well, on that note, we might as well move on. Jesus. I can't segue. Damn. Oh, fucking. Anyway, whatever. Fine. God, we dated this podcast as well. Anyway, so moving on. Andy, it's your pick for The Kid I Saw in My Dreams, Volume 1. As a quick side note, as a programming note, I had a dick of a time trying to find this and buy it, because on Kobo, it's got the romanized title for some bastard reason, for Volume 1, but not for Volume 2. So I was very confused. But please, Andy, take it away.
So For the Kid I Saw in My Dreams is the latest series from Kei Sanbei, who wrote Erased. And I mean, I guess it's kind of a starting point to that. I know a lot of people kind of liked Erased initially and kind of went off it big time in its sort of back half, final act in particular. Personally, I kind of liked Erased all the way through. Like, I totally see why a lot of people went cold on it at some point, and I think a lot of people had very, very fair and kind of telling reasons why they kind of went lukewarm or cold on the series. But I gave it a lot of rope, and I kind of enjoyed it from beginning to end. So I was kind of curious to see, you know, what that author would do in another work, given that, you know, Erased for all of its issues was kind of critically and commercially successful in the end. And For the Kid I Saw in My Dreams it kind of touches on some of the similar points of Erased. It is basically the story of a boy whose name is Senri Nakajo, who, as a 5-year-old, his family is murdered. His parents are killed. His twin brother goes missing and then is later murdered. Yes, or is he? ? You know, he survives this traumatic event, but obviously it has an impact on him. And because he's a twin brother, he kind of has this weird sort of like telepathic link with his twin, where, you know, it used to be the case that if one of them got hurt, the other would feel the pain, and they'd also often kind of see visions of what the other person was seeing at the time of that painful event. And so Senri kind of has this image in his head of what he calls the fireman, who is seemingly the person that murdered his brother, who is only really recognisable by a very kind of distinctive tattoo, which is kind of looks a lot like the Japanese character for fire, hence the name. And so we then kind of fast forward effectively to Senri as a teenager, where he's basically a bit of an asshole. He's effectively he's effectively running a scam with this bunch of other thugs where basically these thugs go and kind of shake a kid down for money. The kid then goes to Senri to say, hey, I've heard you like help people out, get their money back if they've been mugged or whatever. He says, oh yeah, sure. But he's actually in on the whole thing. So he kind of like takes part of the money back, gets kind of faux beaten up for his efforts. And then he kind of gets a cut of the money that he's recovered. But of course the majority of it still kind of ends up going back to this group. And so there's this whole thing going on. But alongside that, he kind of happens upon what appears to be kind of a very important lead in finding the murderer of his brother, and starts to pursue that as well. And I came into this kind of like, I'd heard some negative kind of thoughts about the series, but I came into it thinking like, hey, like given the author's previous work, like I'm sure I'll find something that I can kind of glob onto that's interesting or positive or kind of, you know, perhaps gives me hope for future volumes. Unfortunately, I didn't. Like, there is...
Oh.
this series is kind of relentlessly dark, and I'm okay with that. Like, I'm all for kind of works that kind of delve deep into the depths of kind of depraved humanity. But, like, you've got to have a justification. You've got to have a good narrative to push that forward. Or you've got to kind of balance it out. You've got to... I mean, to take a series we've talked about on this podcast, like Until Your Bones Rot, which is not, you know, a classic that we've talked about on the show, but, like, it's a good example of how you can have this very kind of dark story about, you know, kind of murder and you know, et cetera, but it also knew how to lighten that up with kind of just, like, everyday school life and, you know, kids goofing around and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And Erase, for the kid I saw in my dreams has none of that. Like, yep. The main character is relentlessly kind of miserable and obsessed with kind of catching this killer, and, you know, even when he's not doing that, no, he's engaging in these other nefarious activities. There's a girl who is kind of like a childhood friend of his, whose name has just escaped me. But, like, there's a point where they go to her backstory, and I thought, okay, well, maybe she's going to be kind of like the counterweight, the balance to Senri's kind of attitude. But then it turns out, you know, her...
That's also unrelentingly dark.
Yeah, exactly.
And just rough, frankly.
Yeah, like her parents have, you know, are no longer kind of in her life for very dark reasons. And, like, there's just not even kind of the slightest chink of light to it. And it just, it's really hard reading because, like, none of the characters are particularly likable. I mean, again, Senri doesn't even kind of work as an anti-hero. Like, he's not kind of your typical sort of bad boy who kind of, like, he has a heart of gold at the end of the day. Like, you know, when push comes to shove, he'll do the right thing. Like, he's,
nope.
He is completely kind of self-centered and self-absorbed in what he wants or feels he needs to do. He has no interest in anybody else or, like, what happens to them. And, you know, all the characters he hangs out with are you know, literally a bunch of thugs. Even the character who he quote-unquote, like, helps as part of this scam at the start of it, like, turns out to be like an evil kind of, you know, ne'er-do-well as well. And it's just like the only characters that seem like they're possibly decent people, basically they're just kind of like sidelines, just sort of background characters just there because they kind of have to be. And it's just that there's nothing that kind of lets you either really sympathize with the characters or give you any kind of reason to want them to kind of to move forward with the things that they're trying to do, which is a big departure, because, like, the big thing about Erase was, like, there was a very clear and kind of interesting murder mystery that you could build a good thriller around. There were some dark topics of obviously murder and child abuse, but, like, they were handled in a relatively sensitive way. They were also kind of well handled in terms of, you know, giving you that kind of lightness of everyday life alongside that stuff. It wasn't just relentlessly focused on those things. And it kind of feels like the author kind of went away from the end of Erase, said, okay, I need to write a new series. What are all the things that made Erase so popular? And he wrote down a list of completely the wrong things. And I really actually actively disliked this series, and I was not expecting to come here, like, saying that in such a kind of vehement way.
No, I must admit, like, at the risk of sounding really facile and kind of rolling over, I entirely agree. Like, I wasn't a fan of Erased I only watched a few episodes of it, frankly, but it turned me off. Basically, I just couldn't get into it. It never really won me over. And I was determined, like, once I found out the author's name, I was determined to give this series a fair shake, like, because it, you know, knowing the author's pedigree and how much people liked Erased, like, disagreements aside, I wanted to give this a go, but I just couldn't get into it at any stage. Like, as you mentioned, the main character is a complete arsehole. He's both an awful person, but also highly ineffectual at actually following through on his, like, vengeance. He falls in with that bad crowd who almost act as a surrogate family, but they're also arseholes, apart from that one bespectacled guy who also you barely learn anything about or get anything about or learn anything about apart before bad things befall them. This, as you say, it's a constant sort of sequence of bad events that are really grim, and there's no up on ramp to any of it. Like, it goes from, like, oh, whatever, this guy's a fixer, to punch in the face, to my family was brutally murdered, to, like, you know, here's this nice female sex side character's story, except that she just thirsts or just, like, big sisters the main character constantly, which she, and she gets a rough deal as a result, and really is just kind of shat upon by the story. And I really found that really distasteful beyond anything of how much she goes out to protect the main character. And when he really doesn't deserve it in any way, and is so thankless at every point. Like, it goes from, like, naught to characters dousing themselves in gasoline in about two chapters. And some of the jumps in logic and structure just doesn't work for me, because nothing, it doesn't hang together. Like, there's nothing for me to grip onto. Like, even the, like, source murder thing, like, it goes from who killed my parents to I saw him on TV in, like, one chapter, and it's like, holy shit, like, have some moderation in your storyline. And it all seemed contrived at every point, and, like, the punk kid who got beaten up for his money turning out to then be, like, a weird long con Yakuza plant thing is dumb and doesn't make sense, and also just exists to make the whole thing way more grim. And a lot of the time I was sat there thinking, like, clearly this is supposed to be in, like, a present day, present time, general reality sort of series. But I'm like, this wouldn't happen. Would this happen? No, this wouldn't happen. This is stupid. This wouldn't happen. Why would anyone do that? And that's kind of what I kept coming back to, was this is not, like, believable. Like, I just don't believe any of this. I don't like the characters. I don't want to glom onto any of it. And it kind of left me cold. Like, I read it, obviously, from cover to cover, and just none of it really grabbed me. And towards after the end of the volume, as soon as I finished it, I was like, oh, thank God that's over, because I just did not care. And as I say, the secondary female character, whose name I forget, the one with duck lips, like, she was, I really liked her as a character, but she's just stuck in this shit series and just actively don't care, like, aggressively don't care about the central mystery, the characters, and everything it brings up. Got quite heated there. I just actively found myself just actively disliking all of it and feeling quite irritated, because it's like, there could be something here. Like, I like a good murder mystery. I still watch, like, you know, Silent Witness and shit, but no, just this was just not charming, not interesting, not good.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of what sinks it beneath the surface ultimately, is just, like, the fact that that core murder mystery part just has nothing compelling to it at all. Like, you know, that there are so many ways that you can make that kind of storyline fascinating in terms of, you know, the trail of clues that's been left, or, you know, just something that gives you that kind of breadcrumb trail that you can slowly build up over time. But like you say, it goes from, like, oh, you know, somebody murdered my family, to, like, oh, I know vaguely what they look like, to, like, oh, look, well, they're on TV in no time at all. Like, there's no satisfaction to that. And then even from there, like, they're, you could probably even still at that point build it up into kind of a slow burn of, like, well, I've seen this guy on TV, now how do I find him? But, like, he goes to the place and then they're just like, oh yeah, I know where he lives now. And then it's just like, it's just this constant, you know, it kind of feels like a sort of, I don't know, like a sort of quickly knocked together, like, game jam, like, text RPG effectively, of just like, hey, I only had time to, like, program this really quickly, so it's just like, you know, you just go from point to point to point and then you win, hurrah. And it's just like, there's no kind of efforts involved in any of it. It's all just this really kind of dull, laborious, just like go press this button, then the next thing happens. Like, it just feels very mechanical.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, especially on the push button element of it, because like it constantly brings up and then resolves things far too quickly for it to provide any suspense or interest. It's like, oh, why is he at a, why the orphanage? Oh, here's why. Why this? Oh, here's why. Oh, why? Oh, this is the second to last time I saw my brother's, like, you know, sight. Okay. And then it's like, and then, and it just resolves, especially with the brother, the missing brother, like it resolves it so hastily and forcibly that also, like, part of me thinks, man, that was a fucking waste of a good idea and a good hook. Oh, but what if this is like a very obvious, like very foregrounded smokescreen to make you think it's resolved, but actually it's not. And it's like, but even so, if that was the case, it has zero cachet because I've already seen it coming. And I'm like, either way, the author has written it in a way that no matter how they resolve that plot point, either, you know, for the surprise or the not surprise, like it's not going to be a surprise either way. It's going to be like, no matter what, they've managed to write a plot point, more than one, that is just unsatisfying, no matter how it resolves. It's really wild. Yeah. When is he like, you know, the kid getting beaten up and the various Yakuza people and all these elements just, it's really bizarre because I can see the elements and go, well, this is an element you've written, surely. But no matter what you do, I don't want this element to be here and it's unsatisfying. So you're going to have to, if I want to keep reading this, I'd have to go through an awful lot of story I don't give a shit about. So
for sure. I mean, a friend of the show, Demuzz Ward, asked like a two-pronged question, and one part of that question was thoughts about what happened to Senri's brother. I've seen differing opinions on if he's still kicking about or not, and it's like my answer to that is like, I really don't care.
Yeah, same.
Like, you know, I didn't even really take any time thinking about the possibility of that, because it was just, again, because everything just moves on so quickly, it doesn't even give you that loitering, again, much as people are probably fed up of us kind of citing The Promised Neverland every single episode. Like, you know, that's a really good example of a series that kind of can give you that lingering doubt over whether something you've seen has actually happened, but it does it in a way that is, it's smart enough to not telegraph it one way or the other, but it does kind of like make you actually kind of care about what that eventual outcome was and whether there is more to it than what you've kind of seen on page. Whereas with this, it's just like straight away we were just moving on to, you know, point X, and there was no time to even kind of submerse myself in the world enough to think like, oh well, I wonder whether, you know, there is more to it, maybe there's another layer to this, because it was just instantly kicking the can down the road to the next plot point.
Yeah, and also just kicking plot points out of touch entirely. I say, oh, that's not a problem anymore, I guess, but that would have been a good idea to And also, final thing, I fucking hate the art. I don't like it. I just don't like how the author draws characters. Half the time they look weirdly plasticine-y and just awful, and I just don't like how he draws the characters. I dislike the weird gaze it has on the female side character. Like, it always feels weirdly, like, I don't know, maybe it's just me paying attention, maybe it's just more a failing of me than the author, but I feel like her chest size changes depending on how it wants to view her in the scene. And it was one of those things that once I noticed it, I couldn't unnotice it, which was annoying. And I just don't like the art. I just don't like how it draws the characters. Like, it didn't feel dynamic. It just felt like plasticine weird puppets. So maybe it's just me, but ugh, no, couldn't get on with
it. Yeah, I mean, again, that was the second part of the Demuzz Ward's question. How we fared with Yoh. No, I think it's good. It's good that we covered these things. And yeah, like it's weird because, I mean, the one thing that I could say is as a positive in inverted commas is like the artwork fits the story in that it's really drab and dark as well. But you know, that's,
jeez, Andy,
I feel like that's not even really kind of a deliberate thing, because I mean, again, it's the one part I didn't like about the Erased Manga is I was not a big fan of the artwork, and yeah, like it feels very kind of scratchy and kind of rough. Like it doesn't really have anything that makes it kind of stand out as being anything special. And yeah, like the character designs are kind of, you know, again, they kind of just feel lifted and dropped in and kind of changed slightly from Erased in terms of, you know, what it's doing there. And Yeah, there's nothing kind of interesting in kind of the paneling or the backgrounds or anything about it that makes it stand out. So even from a visual point of view, you know, you can't kind of say like, oh, well, you know, I'm enjoying the aesthetic of this world or something, because it's all just really kind of bland and just kind of, it's there, and that's about the best thing you can say about it.
I definitely agree with you there, especially like, you know, the primary like murder scene you get shown of like, oh, kid sees his family murdered. And it's just, as you say, it's just kind of there. Like, there's nothing too shocking or, you know, sort of scary about it. It's just like, bloop. It's like, oh, it's a 2-page spread of a murder scene. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it. Yeah. And that's really sad. Like, that really sucks. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, you like compare that to something like Until My Bones Rot, which like did some decent kind of like, you know, sort of body horror, if you like, with some of that stuff of just like, oh, this is like, you know, this is a dead person and this is really gross.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I'm having read volume 2 of that, I need to catch up and read more because I got volume 3 somewhere, but like the one thing that series does is it uses all its tools to make it feel gross. Like, it has character reaction, it has facial expression, it has sound effects, it doesn't show you too much. Like, it makes things gross by eliding the fact that, hey, they're cutting up a corpse, yo, but it elides it carefully, but it makes very clear that this is effing gross, and like all the surroundings are like moldy and gross and wretched, and it brings everything to the fore to say, hey, this is sucks. And yeah, totally, wouldn't it? But yeah, that's what, as you say, Until My Bones Rot, like, is really good at that, whereas like some of the more supposed like shocking scenes, or what are supposed to be shocking scenes in Kid I Saw in My Dreams, it's just like, here you go, and it's like, oh, okay, that kid got cold cocked, all right.
Yeah,
that's kind of it.
Yeah, and it's like that, absolutely, especially because I mean that is kind of that's kind of the first establishing shot of this volume, if you like, is kind of leading up to like, oh, this entire family has just been murdered. Like, that should be something where you turn the page and you just kind of like, you are taken aback by it. Like, it should have some kind of reaction from the reader. Like, you know, no matter how deadened you are to kind of, you know, violence on TV and books and manga, whatever, like, it should, even on some kind of tiny level, should have a little moment of like a little intake of breath. But like, there's just nothing. It's like, oh, okay, yep, they're dead, right, next page.
Yeah,
and like that is a huge failing for something. And again, like, it's something that I find like is increasingly important to me. Like, the more stuff we read on this podcast is like the importance of that first impression of what you convey and how you convey it in those first few pages and first few panels. And this is a really good example of just kind of just falling flat, like right at the first hurdle, because you're trying to show something that is shocking and is setting the tone for everything to come, but it just, you feel nothing from it.
Okay. So we were talking about, as you were saying, Andy, before, we've had a few technical issues, so hopefully I'm not talking across purposes. One thing that you say is definitely like the ability to set out a stall. And, you know, admittedly, we do one volume on this podcast, with the option to go back and do it again, do more. But I feel like one volume is kind of like enough rope with which to hang yourself or to set out your stall properly. And, you know, you get other series which we've covered that hook you way faster than this. Even something like, you know, even something like So I'm a Spider, So What was really successful at hooking me, because it's like, oh, you know, it's absurd on its face, but it's very good at saying, hey, here's my stall, here's how we lay it out, and are you interested? Good, let's continue. So whereas this series, like, just right from the off, it's like, oh, okay, you're, and just, you know, the suspension of disbelief never took, and from there it was just a downward slope. Which was kind of something I wrote in my notes over on again and again, is like, I'm just not into this. Like, I just don't have skin in the game.
My literal note was like, I have no reason to care. And it's just like that was kind of what sank it for me. Because, you know, without a compelling core tenet to the story, or without compelling characters that you at least want to see, you know, then make progression in whatever it is they want to do, there's just nothing to keep you going. And I couldn't find anything to kind of, you know, stick a flag in that regard.
Yeah, it's real wild from like a, especially, you know, reading it for a podcast, you know, wanting to dig into it. It drove me nuts, frankly, like going, I want to get into this to have things to talk about. And unsurprisingly, the fact I couldn't is what I can talk about now. But it's this maddening thing of like, I can't get into this. Like, I just want to stick my claws in. But no, it just wasn't happening. So, yeah, real wild when you're, like, sat in the cafe trying to furiously read this volume of manga that I just was being repelled from. It was real wild. One of those weird privileges of, like, having, like, the ability to discuss it with someone else as well on a podcast is, like, man, this is not something you normally experience is this weird reaction. So kind of weird, yeah. a weird thing. That's the most bizarre backhanded compliment perhaps ever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty weird for me to kind of read or watch anything and just have, you know, no kind of connection to it whatsoever. There's usually something, no matter how small, that you can say, yeah, but this little thing was really fascinating, but it's just like, no, just nothing doing here.
Yeah, I mean, even the, like, as I mentioned again, like, the female secondary character, really wanted to like her, really couldn't bring myself to, was really felt really weird about it. And to finish the other part of Demel's awards question about if Senri's brother is kicking, yeah, I don't know. I think just repeat what I said earlier of, like, I kind of don't care anymore. Like, maybe he is, maybe he isn't. Kind of don't care. Okay, so we've got nothing more to say on Erased?
No,
I mean, Kid You Saw in My Dreams? Shit.
Yes, that too.
Damn, I'm going to leave that in as a monument to my stupidity. Okay, cool. So, going to speed up a bit now because our recording software is trying to kick us both in the teeth. So, what are we going to be talking about next time? So, I am nominating After Hours, Volume 1. It is a 3-volume adult Yuri manga. Adult in the case that the characters are adults and have responsibilities and it's not just another school thing. I've had this for like 6 months and haven't read it yet, so I'm using the podcast as an excuse. And Andy, how about you?
Because I like picking things that are hard to say for this podcast, I have picked The Quintessential Quintuplets, Volume 1, which is a series that I've seen a bunch of people talking about online. It's one of the kind of anime adaptations that seems to have caught with a bunch of people, so I thought, heck, why not? Let's read the first volume of that.
So, fun adventure. I've already read this previously because I bought it when it was on sale somewhere, but I'll keep my gob shut and my powder dry until next time. But yeah, I already have strong opinions on it, so hooray. Cool. So thank you very much for listening. This has been Screen Tone Club. Our website is available at screentone.club, where you can find all of our previous podcasts and a list of all the shows series we've covered. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, other sites. If your podcatcher has a review function, we'd be very grateful if you used it, because that stuff really helps push it up the, like, discoverability stakes. If you are interested in more podcasts and supporting the show, please have a little look at our Patreon, which is available at patreon.com/screentoneclub. You can also find our Twitter at screentoneclub on the Twitter. I can now use it again because I've been unbanned. Whoops. Don't get upset at US elected representatives and say, untactful things to them. You can email us at show@screentone.club. As for personal stuff, my name is Elliot, and you can find my Twitter feed, which is now much more calm, at Elliot Page. I have cat pictures. And Andy, how about you?
Yeah, my name is Andy Hanley, and you can find my latest health status on Twitter at Hannah's1979.
At Hannah's1979, cough, cough. Cool. Thank you very much for listening. Man, this took longer than we expected due to audio nonsense. But yeah, we'll look forward to hearing from you, well, when it comes to our next episode and our bonus episode. So, thanks, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.